Okay, so last week we were talking about the different proofs of the Torah. First, any questions on last week upon reflection or anything like that? Anyone with any follow-up questions on that?
The story of Noah.
Okay.
How does that fit into everything? Why is it significant for the story of Noah to be in the Torah, in the Chumash?
It's a really cool story.
It's a cool story. It's a bit far-fetched.
Far-fetched? Well, what's your question? Is your question is it makes the Torah less believable, or why is it in the narrative versus other stories?
The practicality of it. I mean, was it possible to take two genders of every species on the boat? I mean, how real is it?
The Torah's account is that it's real. So, I mean, I think the point last week was more proving the Torah's uniqueness as a whole. There's a ton of stories we can get into. I mean, is the story of Noah any more or less believable than the 10 plagues or the splitting of the sea or this, that, or the other thing? So,
these were miracles. The story of
that's a miracle too. Why isn't that a miracle that all the animals showed up?
That's considered a miracle?
So, yeah, something like
that. They didn't eat each other either.
Yeah.
We don't know that.
Well, no, that's
right?
One of the miracles is that, yeah, the lions didn't jump the gates and go after the antelopes and the zebras.
Weren't the kosher animals more of them than two?
The seven of the kosher animals, so they could offer sacrifices after. So let me just conclude with two things from last week. One thing to add, and maybe I was alluding to this, but I didn't put it this way, but I was thinking about it, was that maybe a good way of putting what I was trying to say. We talked a lot about Moses and the way he's depicted in the Torah, but making it not just about Moshe, but a little bit larger scale, is that the Torah is writing from a place of confidence. Okay? It's not trying to convince you of anything. I think that's the uniqueness of it. It's not trying to impress you with grandiose statements of what this person was, what God was. It's not trying to convince you of anything. And that's a very kind of basic tenet of most major religions, is they're trying to convince you and to convince outsiders how amazing this is. Right? And join our religion because our guy walks on water, turns water into wine, and heals the sick and whatever, right? There's a lot of convincing going on. There's a lot of almost justification. The Torah doesn't bother itself with that. If anything, the Torah is downplaying their heroes. And all the heroes are very flawed, you know? And even if they're not flawed, they're taken advantage of. Or they're shown to be put in very difficult circumstances. And we're talking about what, you know, the possibility that a group writes this down, or a group is saved from Egypt, and then they kind of write up this history, so they have some sort of, or there is some history, but they add to it and they embellish it and makes it more impressive, right? And that was kind of one of the working theories we're working with, is alternatives to the Torah being from God. But I think one of the major problems with that theory is no nation trying to impress people, trying to give themselves, make themselves look great, and their history look great, is going to create stories like Joseph's brother selling him. Oh yeah, and that's 11 of the 12 of us. Those are our ancestors. 11, you know, more than 90% of this nation, we're going to create a story that makes our ancestors selling another one. Okay. Right, they wouldn't have the story of Judah and Tamar. They wouldn't have the story of Yaakov being tricked by his father-in-law and marrying Leah first. It wouldn't make any sense to create a fictitious book where this is your history. Why would anybody do that? If anything, you'd go to the opposite extreme. So that's something that Torah is writing from a place of confidence. It's not trying to impress you. It's not trying to convince you of anything. This is the story. This is the real story. And it's coming from that place of, I don't care if you believe it. This is what happened. Believe it, don't believe it, no skin off my back. Right? When you're coming from a place of confidence, you don't really care if people are impressed by it or listening to it or not. So that was kind of fleshing out the point I was making last week. Dirk last week asked about the documentary hypothesis, and I talked to him about this yesterday because I knew he couldn't be here tonight, so we spoke about it yesterday a little bit. So here is basically the documentary hypothesis. Is anyone familiar with it or no? Okay. This is very, very popular amongst academic circles and very, very popular amongst, certainly in the conservative movement. It's like, it's huge. The reform movement too. But it's very, very big in those circles. And I'll talk about this a little bit more later on as well, but in the three panel discussions I've had with the conservative reform rabbis, every session the documentary hypothesis comes up. Because one or both of them will just say, I believe the Torah, the construct of the Torah is as the documentary hypothesis describes it. And so what Dirk was saying, because Dirk was a member of a conservative show for many years, he said that the rabbi would always talk about the documentary hypothesis as like his theory of where the Torah comes from. So I'll briefly describe what it is. The documentary hypothesis posits that there were three separate authors to the Torah, which it gives titles for, by single letter titles. So one is Y. Y is for Hashem, right? Yud and Hey, then Vav and Hey, the way it's described. Okay. The second one is E, which is for Elohim. The third one thing is P for priestly, a priest, and the fourth is D for Deuteronomy. And what it basically says is that independently, all four of them wrote books for this burgeoning Jewish people, religion. The theory is that these books were all written, I believe the time period is around 850 to 600 BCE. That's the theory. Which puts you in First Temple period. First Temple period. They're all written First Temple period. So this is post-King David, post-King Solomon. This is already very established people who have their own country, who have their temple, who have won many wars, and are at the height of their powers in many ways. So, the concept is that these four independently write these books, and then at some point later in history, probably the end of this time period, near the end of the First Temple period, someone compiles them and makes them into one text. And pretty much all of the proofs are either inconsistencies in the text, in the Chumash, the fact that Chumash will skip from different types, from narrative to law, certain things are out of order chronologically. Different books have very different purposes, right? The first book of Bereishit is all the stories from Adam until Joseph's death. Then the second book is all about slavery and redemption. Third book is all about mostly about the sacrifices. Deuteronomy is Moses' last speech to the Jewish people at the end of his life. So since they have different feels to them, different contexts, different purposes, so they're written by four different people. And I can get into who wrote what. And, you know, the priestly is basically all the sacrifices and things done in the temple. These are two different descriptions of God who had different purposes. One was a more global perspective, namely the stories. This one is more about Jewish law. This one is the last book of the Torah. That's the theory. Personally, I thought I'd be a lot more impressed by it than I was. I really don't get the appeal of this theory whatsoever. First of all, this came up a lot last week, was number one, we don't know their names, which is to me is already absurd. We don't know who writes these things, right? And then we later have someone compile them. We don't know who that person is. This is just after the right, like 2,500 years later, we magically figure out, going back, that this is what happened with absolutely no indication. In 2,500 years of Jewish texts, and all Jew and all Jews did was write for 2,500 years. And there's no mention of this anywhere. It's hard to understand. This theory begins to come about in the 1700s, and then gets more and more popular in the 1800s, and then even today it's very, there's already a lot of variations of it and aspects of it. It's also very late. I mean, this is already the First Temple period, so there's about 500 years. 400 years from the times of Joshua when the Jews entered the land of Israel to the building of to King Saul, which then pretty soon is the building of the temple. So about 500 years from Joshua until the building of the temple. So you've got these people who for 500 years, so they don't have a book, they don't have a story. It's written later. I mean, this is when it's all written down. Why is it written down beforehand? Why are they making all this stuff up about Moses? Did it happen? I don't know. Anyway, I don't want to talk too much about it because that was the purpose of my class. That's the basic theory. I don't know. I thought I'd have to really talk about it, but I just think it's kind of silly, really. What? I really don't think it's that. I think there's much better questions in the Torah than this. Yeah.
And so, do conservative and the reform, the other branches is this a well-accepted sort of...
Yeah, they love it. They love it. I mean, people love this theory.
What is it about it that you think is...
Yeah,
so
I'll tell you what I think it is. I'll tell you my theory on the theory. but the other thing to me is that this is... There's no historical evidence. There's no, proof of manuscripts or scrolls that had the Torah written, one of these four, their manuscript, which before it was compiled into one. There's no mention of it anywhere. I mean, 2,500 years later, for someone to come along and through the text ask questions and then say, well, it must have been written by different people. I mean, that's such a flimsy argument. And besides the fact that the Talmud asks numerous times, why is this out of order? Why is this tone different? Why is Deuteronomy written different than the other ones? It was not like these questions didn't exist. These questions were asked in the Talmud, 1,500 years or 1,200 years before this theory. So my belief is this. And, you know what? Hold off on it. We'll get into reform, and then I'll tell you why I think this is a big thing. It ties in. Okay. So today we're going to focus mostly in the reform movement. We'll get into the conservative movement, but you can't really get into the conservative movement until you understand the reform movement, because the reform movement is the much bigger step. Because now, when do you think the reform movement begins? Just
1780s or somewhere.
19th century.
Okay.
Moses Mendelssohn.
Okay.
After the Enlightenment.
Okay, good. So, yeah, basically, I mean... End of the 1800s, beginning of the end of the 18th century, beginning of the 19th century.
The age of reason.
Yeah, and it's very much connected to all that. If Moses Mendelssohn is connected to the reform movement, is he a precursor to the reform movement? That's a big debate, because in some ways he is, in some ways he really isn't. But I think he's part of the general conversation. Is that in the Age of Enlightenment, as Jews are getting accepted? There is this push to figure out how are Jews going to fit into this new society. This was a radical diversion from what Jews were used to, right? Jews were not used to being accepted. Jews were not used to having any doors open to them. And now, in a pretty short amount of time, this is beginning to happen. In certain places, obviously, not everywhere. So in the places that these things were beginning to happen... The question was, how could Jews pull this off? So there are a lot of different approaches. Moses Mendelssohn was definitely one of the first to really embrace this concept of trying to become part of the society, but remain observant. He remained observant until the end, but his grandchildren, especially his great-grandchildren, pretty much all left the faith. And that was mostly because, certainly at that time, Germany in the early 1800s, you had to be Christian to make it in society. We'll accept you now. We'll tolerate you now. But doesn't mean you're going to work your way up the You can't really climb the social ladder unless you're Christian, unless you're part of the club. So a lot of Jews were converting because that was the way to make it. That was the way to and even then, you know, you probably would get looked at suspiciously. So a lot of Jews did half-hearted conversions to Christianity because that was the they felt needed to be done. So there were some people who began to try to teach Judaism in a new way. Mendelssohn was one, Schimmel for Hirsch is one. Especially coming out of Germany, there was a number of people, and there was a rabbinic school that was kind of created. There's Rav Hildesheimer, there's Rav David Zvi Hoffman. So there was a push to really re-explain what Judaism was about. Rav Hirsch is probably the most prominent of them. He was a prolific writer. His commentary on the Chumash, he writes a book called Chorev, where he describes, where he tries to give reasons for the mitzvot to make them relevant. Something called the 19 letters, where he writes, you know, fake letters, right? He writes the questions, then he gives the answers, right? But he basically asks the questions that were being asked at that time, and he gives responses to them about Judaism and philosophy, a lot of different issues. So these issues were being dealt with, and they were being dealt with in Germany, because Germany was the place where these things were happening. So Germany was also the place where the Reform movement takes off. The Reform movement definitely changes through the years. It begins, like most of these things begin, as subtle changes, smaller changes. And whenever a change was made, there was a justification within Jewish law. Okay? So you want to put an organ in the shul. So it wasn't just we'll put an organ in the shul. It was explained why this is okay within Jewish law. And they actually even kind of hired some scholars, some Jewish scholars, to, you know, they basically would say, okay, here's what we want to do. Write something up for us, right? Find us a loophole, right? Rabbi, you know, tell me why you can do this. So there definitely was some of that. But that was short-lived, meaning pretty soon, you know, because in the beginning they were trying to work within the construct of the Orthodox community. And at a certain point they just gave up any desire to do that, and they just formed their own separate community. Now, it's not that Judaism has not had different sects before, right? There's been plenty through the years, through the centuries. You just go back, I mean, name a point in history and there'll be groups that separated, splintered from the pack. During the First and Second Temple period, that was very common. You had the Tzedokim, what's the English for that? Sadducees, yeah, always better there. So the Tzedokim, or the Sadducees, and then kind of their later counterpart, the Karaites, who believed in strict interpretation of the written Torah. There's no oral law, and there's no rabbinic laws, and they had a very different concept of the Torah. And the Karaites, actually, like we talked about the Karaites when we did history of Torah, the Karaites had at points in history a very, very strong following, and even exist in small numbers today. And right, we talked about the Daily City. There's this Karaite temple.
It's not far from our house.
Yeah, where is it?
It's like three blocks. It's over by that that gym, that purple and yellow gym. Yeah.
I'm up for a field trip if anybody else is, by the way.
Yeah.
I'm so up for this field trip. It's so fascinating. I mean, do you know how rare it is to have in your backyard a Karaite temple? I mean, like, who cares such a thing? It's amazing.
How many members there?
I don't know.
Let's have a field trip.
I'm really, like, I'd love to go there and, like, you know, find out what, you know, what the story is.
So we would have to make arrangements with them to coordinate it.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah, yeah. I would go. I mean, I don't know. Maybe I'd be putting hair in, but I would go for sure. Okay.
On a Wednesday.
I know. Yeah, I'm saying we'll do a class field trip. Yeah, I'm serious. Yeah.
I'm taking people.
Okay, I mean it's Daily City. You know? It's not going to be very far.
What? We could go there.
Well, let's not get crazy. Let's not get crazy. The lights will be off. There's no heat on. Probably it's not going to be fun. What?
We could get invited for Shabbos
Day. We'll invite them to us for Shabbos. But on a Wednesday night, you know, I'd be open to that. Anyway, so this wasn't... It's not that there'd never before been anything like this. And there's been different attempts to interpret the Torah in different ways. What you had here, I think that was unique to Jewish history, and unique in that it's lasted so long, is that the Reform Movement began to redefine Judaism in some very significant ways. And we'll get into exactly what they did, and we'll read through their own description of what they've done. But the central thing is they begin to change major tenets of Judaism. So we'll go through them, and when they define themselves, they use a few different categories. So as they begin to develop, in the beginning, they're feeling themselves out, and there's a few main things that they want to do. Okay, so one main thing that they want to do is they want to make the service more church-like. Okay? So how do you make a Jewish service more church-like, besides not serving children to the Jewish?
Make it on Sunday.
What?
Make it on Sunday.
Okay, so one thing they did is they made it on Sunday. Right? So many reform movements made Shabbat on Sunday. Okay, so you had Sunday.
They have organs.
What?
They have the organs.
Okay, the organ.
I guess
service
is not in Hebrew.
Service is not in Hebrew, right? German services. But specifically not Hebrew.
It's German?
Vernacular.
What?
German?
It starts in Germany.
Oh, okay.
It's the vernacular.
What? In the vernacular. That would be impressive.
Let me start it from singing.
The choir. Sing? Singing's been going on forever.
Yeah.
The singing's not unique, but... the choir was unique.
The
choir, interestingly enough, even the Orthodox groups in Germany kind of form choirs.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and there's a
cappella.
Yeah, there's this German Jewish community in Washington Heights called the Breuers community, and that's where a lot of the German Jews settled. A lot of upstate New York is those that did farming, and other with Washington Heights, where a lot of them settled, and there's still this community there. And there's the shul called the Breuer Shul, which goes back to a remnant of Rev Shimshon Frel Hirsch. And in their shul, they have a choir. It's a fascinating little place. It's not so little. It's a pretty big place. And I used to dive in there sometimes. It's very close to YU. It's like a 10-minute, 15-minute walk. So, you know, I'll go there sometimes. I never heard the choir, but I really should have. I didn't take advantage of it.
The amount of prayer.
What?
They
shorten the prayer and they take a lot of things out of the prayer, which we'll get to as well. Okay, so one thing is service. I'm going to run in a room here. Okay, so these are a lot of it's making the services more. What did I just erase?
Choir.
Okay. So it's making them more church-like. It's making them feel less different. Less different. Okay, now what else? So what else? Number two.
Remove the mechitza.
Well, that's true. That's a good one also. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Good point. Mixed seating. I don't think, I'm positive actually, that there's no women rabbis in 1870s Reform temples. That was not happening. That was only happening much later when that was a general societal trend. But... that was not happening.
Didn't they change, like...
no lesbian rabbis in there.
Oh, sorry. Gender neutral as far as not saying he, referring to God as he.
I suspect that came later on.
I'm not sure.
I suspect that just came later on.
So that I'm not sure.
Okay.
I mean, there definitely was also inclusion of certain references. Yeah. Well, definitely aspects of the prayers are definitely changed. Instead of only Avraham Yitzchak and Yaakov, it's obviously like Yaakov. Sarah, Rivka, and Leah. I don't know exactly when that started them. Because conservative does that now as well.
Yeah.
Yes, I don't know exactly when that started.
When I was a kid in Reform, I don't think we did that.
Didn't do that?
No, I don't think so.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of things that in the past, right, 20 to 30 years have been added as well and changed. We'll get to some of these things. Okay, so that's the service. Ideologically, some major shifts. Number one is... the concept of the Jewish nation. they wanted to remove this concept from Judaism. We're no longer a Jewish nation. We are a
German
religion. Right? Now, this was very significant at that time. Napoleon famously called together a Sanhedrin. Have you ever heard of this? Napoleon Sanhedrin. Where he wanted to figure out if he could trust the Jews, right? He wanted to figure out. What he's basically trying to figure out was, so he called together all these leading rabbis from all over Europe, and he gave them a bunch of questions for them to answer. But the main purpose of the questions was to figure out, if we grant you citizenship, will you really be citizens? Right? Because if you're always pining to return to Israel, if you say, well, Israel's really our homeland, right? Then are you really one of us? If you won't intermarry with anyone but yourselves, are you really one of us? Right? That was, there were like four or five questions that were asked, and those were a few of them. But the main thrust was, are Jews too segregated? Are they willing to really look at themselves as French? So that was this message. The message here before movement was, we are ready to consider ourselves German, right? Or whatever country you're in. We no longer desire to return to Israel. All mentions of returning to Zion will be removed from the prayers. The very concept will be removed because we no longer desire to return. Judaism is not a nation, it's a religion. And that concept of the Jewish nation, they wanted to push aside. Number three is Torah and mitzvot. We no longer say the Torah was definitely written by God, and we no longer say that the mitzvot are necessarily relevant. Okay? The ones that are relevant are the ones that are relevant within our current society. So let me read some for you. So this is the Pittsburgh Platform. The Pittsburgh Platform is from 1885, and it was, as it moved to, as reform moves into America, and has a huge hit in America, very successful. This is the first attempt to really put down on paper to concretize what are the tenets of the reform movement. So I'll read it to you. No reason for us to have to guess. We recognize in every religion an attempt to grasp the infinite, and in every mode, source, or book of revelation held sacred in any religious system the consciousness of the indwelling of God in man. We hold that Judaism presents the highest conception of the God idea as taught in our holy scriptures and developed and spiritualized by the Jewish teachers, in accordance with the moral and philosophical progress of the respective ages. We maintain that Judaism preserved and defended amidst continual struggles and trials and under enforced isolation this God idea as a central religious truth for the human race. Okay, so it seems it's kind of wordy, but Judaism believes in this concept of one God. We recognize in the Bible the record of the consecration of the Jewish people to its mission as the priests of the one God, and value it as the most potent instrument of religious and moral instruction. We hold that the modern discoveries of scientific researches in the domain of nature and history are not antagonistic to the doctrines of Judaism. The Bible, reflecting the primitive ideas of its own age, and at times clothing its conception of divine providence and justice, dealing with man and miraculous narratives. So right, we're getting a sense that the Torah is a bit anachronistic. Right, it's not really quite as relevant as it used to be. We recognize the Mosaic legislation, a system of training the Jewish people for its mission during its national life in Palestine. And today, we accept as binding only its moral laws and maintain only such ceremonies as elevate and sanctify our lives, but reject all such as are not adapted to the views and habits of modern civilization. So Shabbat is not the way the rest of the world functions, so it's out. Kashrut is not the way the rest of the world functions, so it's out. The concept of a mikvah is not the way the rest of the world functions, so it's out. We don't steal. We don't kill. We don't, I know what they would do with a deltary, because that's pretty popular. right?
Oh, it's in.
Right? Set it in. Right? But we'll keep the ones that we want to keep, or we think are relevant. Yom Kippur, yeah, we'll do it because it's how can you drop that? But at the same time, it's not really binding per se. So we hold that all such Mosaic and rabbinical laws as regulate diet, priestly purity, the concept of a Kohen, a Kohen can't go into a cemetery, that's the kind of stuff, and dress originated in ages and under the influence of ideas entirely foreign to our present mental and spiritual state. They fail to impress the modern Jew with the spirit of priestly holiness. Their observance in our days is apt rather to obstruct than to further modern spiritual elevation. So not only are the mitzvot not relevant, they're really holding us back. They're holding back not just our ability to fit into the world, they're holding us back spiritually as well. Okay, so there's a real despising these things. Okay. We recognize in the modern era of universal culture of heart and intellect the approach of the realization of Israel's great messianic hope for the establishment of the kingdom of truth, justice, and peace among all men. We consider ourselves no longer a nation, but a religious community, and therefore expect neither a return to Palestine, nor a sacrificial worship under the sons of Aaron, nor the restoration of any of the laws concerning the Jewish state. We recognize that Judaism is a progressive religion, ever striving to be... Okay, yeah, this we can skip. We reassert the doctrine of Judaism that the soul is immortal, grounding the belief in the divine nature of human spirit, whichever finds bliss in righteousness and misery in wickedness. We reject as ideas not rooted in Judaism the beliefs both in bodily resurrection and the Gehenna and Eden, or heaven and hell, as abodes for everlasting punishment and reward, no concept of heaven and hell. Okay. So basically, we're focusing on Judaism and Torah as being tools to make us better moral people and to help save the world. In reform movement, how is that described? Tikkun Olam. The catchphrase of the reform movement has been for decades, Tikkun Olam, right? Mm-hmm. Now,
so...
What is Tikkun Olam? Heal the world?
Healing the world. Yeah. Making the world a better place. Yeah.
So, now, it seems like if you're going to this is kind of a movement that's born out of people who are feeling pretty good about themselves and don't really, you know, feeling fairly comfortable, meaning not worried about, I guess, being persecuted to
sure.
some extent.
Sure.
It, having gained some sort of social and economic stability in order to say maybe we don't need some of the... I mean, I'm just trying to figure out, like, where did this sort of come from?
Or was
from?
It the other way around, in order to accomplish what you just
yes,
said?
Well, yes,
but, I mean...
There's two places where the reform movement thrives. It thrives in Germany in the 19th century and in America from the late 19th to 20th century. It doesn't thrive anywhere else, even till today. Right, there's no reform movement to speak of in South Africa, in Australia, in Europe, or in South America.
Israel.
Little pockets. In Israel, yeah.
And
a little bit.
A little bit. Again, there's some little, but it hasn't taken... It's really America where it's taken hold.
So in Europe...
Well, let it finish. Okay. Yeah.
So then, in South Africa, so this is where my husband's family's from, you know, I was asking my mother-in-law things like, so did you go to mikveh? Or his grandmother, and she said, I never went to mikveh. So I asked his mom, so what happened to the mikveh in South Africa? there wasn't one.
Right.
So in South Africa, they may not have been observing mitzvot, but they didn't make a conscious effort to, you know, change.
Right, they didn't change, and this is common. Yeah. It's very common, you'll meet someone, especially South African, European, Australian, and they'll say, I'm Orthodox.
Right.
Right? What they mean is, I'm not Reformed. They don't really mean they're wrong, right? They mean I'm not Reformed. They mean, I might not keep many or any of the mitzvot, but I'm not claiming that's, you know, I'm not changing Judaism.
Right.
Yeah, what's going on out there?
It's raining.
It's raining.
They want to go to shul. They want to have chitza. They want to, you know,
the shul I don't go to has to be Orthodox.
No, it has to be Orthodox. Right. I mean, they want the chitza. They want the traditional.
Right. They want the traditional service.
Right.
But they still want to be able to do what they want when they want to do it.
Right? Either they don't do it, or if they do it, they want the real thing.
So I guess what I'm trying to figure out is, like, what made the... What was the sort of driving... Why do they have to create a whole new...
Well, I think there's a bit of cognitive dissonance. There is some...
Gosh.
I don't know. Yeah, right?
Like a sprinkler.
I mean, there is some honesty to this.
Yeah.
You know?
Absolutely.
Over time, there's some honesty. Look, we're just not doing it. You know, we're just not doing it.
Why do they even want to continue that?
Well, they didn't want to be Christian. They don't believe in Jesus and Christianity, right? I mean, even today in America, as secular as it is, how many Jews do you find willingly converting to Christianity? Very few.
But a common argument is, I don't want the service to be in Hebrew because I don't understand Hebrew and I can't feel spiritual because I get hung up on the Hebrew and I don't, you know. So that's a common. So, and I think there's this real drive, this real sort of feeling like I can be more spiritual this way.
No, for sure. Look, right. I mean, well, in modern America, there's a lot of issues of a traditional Jewish life requires a pretty decent education,
right?
To really get integrated fully, and that takes time, and that takes patience, and that takes an admission that I don't really know everything, and it'll take time. I can get there, but gosh, wouldn't it be so much easier if I didn't have to do any of this stuff, and I could just show up, and it's in English, and there's no expectations, and whatever I do is great. Boy, that, you know, it's the path of least resistance, right? So the path of least resistance will feel comfortable, but you're not going to grow all that much, right? You're never going to learn Hebrew if you don't have any. Pull to learn.
Like eat your non-kosher cake and have it too.
Exactly. Yeah.
But was there the sort of situation in Germany where people were less educated, or I mean?
Well, actually, in Germany it was as a whole. Yeah, it was a much more educated. No, that's what I'm saying. In modern America, that's why it's different.
I mean,
yeah.
Now, but like
no,
then,
this was a very conscious. See, the reform movement today is very different than it was then.
Okay.
This was a movement.
Right.
There's a conscious movement.
Right.
Today, the reform movement is not really a movement, besides the rabbis. Meaning, if you go to a reform Jew, or a member of a reform temple, and say, "Don't you love the reform movement?" Right? They're not there for the movement. They're there because they want to be Jewishly connected.
Right.
And that's a pretty simple way to do it. So that's what they do. Do they believe in this? Do they believe in? This is I thought it through. This is what I think the Torah is. This is how only the rabbis are talking about stuff like this. Like that, you know, very few people really care about this. You know, they go to the Reform Temple, so they don't have to care about this. So that's why it's different. But this was a movement. You know, how intellectually honest was it? Not so clear. You know, I'm sure there's some people who really believed it. I'm sure there's many people, whether they really believed it or not, felt like this was what they had to do, or what they wanted to do, or what the next logical step was, based on the time. So it's unclear exactly.
But
you know,
right. It's very hard a Jew to teach their kids or let them go to a school, which is like, let's say in Europe they have school. You have to send your kids back to East, and not everybody comfortable with that.
Back to where?
Back east, to New York, or any...
Who has to do that?
What?
Who has to send their kids to New York?
Well, to send your kids back to high school, let's say, to back to New York. To
which is high school?
To learn, really, the way it should be done.
Oh, well, you're not going to New York for that. New York doesn't have a monopoly on religious education.
Where else are you going to send them?
Cleveland?
No.
Lots of places.
No, I mean, do they have any in San Francisco?
I mean,
no.
There's schools. No, I'm not saying that they're the same quality as other places. Look, there's a lot of communities that have schools that might not be have the same level of learning, but doesn't mean that things can't be augmented. And you know, after high school,
my kids went to the Abraham Academy. It's supposed to be the Jewish school at that time, and my kids were growing up. One day I went to the rabbi and I said to the rabbi Goodman, my kid don't know how to daven. And he said, oh, this kid don't go to the Shabbos. It's a synagogue. That was that.
I can't speak to specific schools and specific eras. I don't have that.
I have a lot of problem with that.
But we're talking about theoretical now. I mean, practically how to educate children today is that's a whole topic to itself. Class. Yeah. But this is more about just philosophically.
If you don't teach your kids.
No, I know. I understand. So here are the kind of the major points that we're talking about. There are many, many mitzvot that initially were taken out. So certainly kashrut was number one on the list. Shabbos was high on the list. There's a big debate about bris milah.
Yeah, I was going
to
say.
Huge debate about bris milah.
That seems to be one that they still, no matter who you are.
There's a very interesting debate because in many ways, if anything, that should have been the first thing to get rid of. Because it's barbaric, it's this and that.
But it was kept.
Well, no, it depended. Every Reformed temple had different.
It was largely kept.
It was largely kept, but there are definitely places where they got rid of it. But at the same time, there was many people who couldn't bring themselves to getting rid of bris milah. That's like, whoa. Well, you know, it's like, you know, there's certain things. It's like, you know, no Passover Seder. Whoa. Like, maybe the Torah is made up. Maybe we never left Egypt. Maybe God doesn't exist. I'm doing a Seder, you know? You know? So, and seriously, I mean, there's certain things that just psychologically, you know, like Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur also could have gone, you know. So certain things just like, were they taking it seriously? No. Were they, you know, were all the traditions of the Seder kept, or is it just a 2-hour thing with like read some Haggadah, eat a matzah, have a meal? Okay, it's probably, you know, it's not the same as a full fledged Seder necessarily, but certain things definitely, you know, remain, you know, didn't really waver. But this is basically the concept. Now, it changes over time, and just for example, in 1990, they've had, I think, four different platforms where they came out with the principles of the Reform movement. There's one in, essentially where they are, there's Columbus, there was Pittsburgh, the last one was Miami, the Miami platform, that sounds nicer than, you know, the Columbus platform. No offense to Columbus. Hey. Nice town, I enjoyed my time there last year for a couple days. But okay, so here, you know, in their modern attempt, you know, it's a bit more fleshed out. This is all available on the Reformed Temple, you know, the Reformed Movement's website, so it's all there. So they flesh it out a little bit more. There's a little, you know, but, and I'll pass it, I'm not going to read it, it's too long to read it, but everyone's welcome to.
It seems like, and maybe I'm wrong, there's a pulling back. They're not going back to keeping Shabbat.
What I would say is
less obvious in your face, you know, kashrut kind of
issues. Yeah. Here. This is a nice little. I'll respond to that in a second. This is from the Reform Temple's Reform Movement's website about what they're about now. In addition to our. Reform Judaism affirms the central tenets of Judaism, God, Torah, and Israel, even as it acknowledges the diversity of Reformed Jewish beliefs and practices. We believe that all human beings are created in the image of God, and that we are God's partners in improving the world. Tikkun Olam, repairing the world, is a hallmark of Reformed Judaism as it strives to bring peace, freedom, and justice to all people. And that's why I'm saying that Tikkun Olam is the catchphrase of the Reform movement. It's a traditional concept of making the world a better place, but the connotation that Reform gives it is, this is our focus as opposed to tradition, right? It doesn't say that, right? It's not, you know, you can't have a movement that says, we're the movement that doesn't follow the Torah.
Right?
And then teach your children, you know what we are? We're the Jews who do nothing. right? That can't be a movement, right? Think, seriously, that can't be a movement. The movement has to be what are you about, right? So, right, we are about social justice.
Right.
We're about the moral aspects of the Torah. We're about making the world a better place, and that's the focus, right? Because there has to be a focus.
Without Torah, the rabbis are no longer rabbis.
Well, it's interesting. I like to joke with the reformed rabbis. It's like, why do you have the Torah in the Ark? It's like, yeah, you bring it out. It's all irrelevant
nonsense.
They reject
the Torah, then they're no longer rabbis. They're social. They're community workers. Yeah.
So, when in the Who is a Jew did the reform, like when, as far as matriarchal?
That's a much more modern thing.
Is that a modern thing?
I think that's like the early 80s.
Okay.
Really, once the reform movement came out and said that if your father's Jewish, the kid's Jewish. Boy, that just blew everything up.
Oh, the bloodline goes to the father?
Or the mother.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, once they gave that, the split that created to all other branches of Judaism, it's like, oh, God. You just redefined the definition of a Jew that's been going on for thousands of years.
When did the mother become the...
Well, that's in the Talmud. The Talmud already says, learning out from passages in the Torah, that it's through the mother. Yeah, I mean that's a.
But it was a rabbi created.
No, their Talmud claims you can learn it out from the Torah itself. So it's never been. I mean they're interpreting the Torah as saying that. It's two different places in the Talmud that discusses
it. It's in the Torah that the mother.
Again, it's the way they. Without getting into all the specifics, but they're learning it out from Sukkim in the Torah. The Talmud learns it out from the verses in the Torah.
Now, they're not, I'd like to see that verse.
Yeah, I could definitely show it to you. Because okay, well, let me just finish this up. Okay, sorry.
Another class.
Yeah, we can't do everything in one class. Reformed Jews accept the Torah as the foundation of Jewish life, containing God's ongoing revelation to our people and the record of our people's ongoing relationship with God. We see the Torah as God-inspired, a living document that enables us to confront the timeless and timely challenges of everyday lives. And this is where I was getting to before, the documentary hypothesis.
The Torah is God-inspired?
So, yeah. So, this is a very big catchphrase you'll hear in Reform and conservative circles, that the Torah is divinely inspired, right? Meaning what? Meaning, the Torah it can't just be the book of our history, because if it's just the book of our history, it's not that relevant, right? The problem of the Reform movement is the more you say the Torah mitzvot are not relevant anymore, then the less relevant the rabbis are and the message is and Judaism is, right? And that just gets, so it's one thing to tell a group of 1825 German Jews who have strong Jewish educations and live in a strong Jewish community,
right?
Okay, we're going to tweak this now, because they have this, they have the basis to work with. But what happens two generations later, when the message for two generations is the Torah is irrelevant and mitzvah we don't have to do, then that's the message, right? And it's lost. I kind of look at it as, the immigrant Eastern European Jews who came to America, they didn't realize that, they thought their kids would understand how important being Jewish is just because they understood it. Right, but they understood it because they grew up in Europe, because they grew up in Warsaw, and they grew up in Hungary, and they grew up in Czechoslovakia, where of course you were Jewish, and of course you married a Jew, and of course you only hung out with Jews because that's all you did, right? And they didn't necessarily didn't compute that in America, it's not going to be that simple, right? And it just didn't keep. So I mean that's part of the problem here is if you keep bashing the Torah, pretty soon you lost your audience, right? Because you can't use the Torah to teach anything because now it's irrelevant. It's an anachronism. So what you have today is this mix of, well, the Torah can't be all from God because then we actually got to do it, right? You can't say the mitzvot aren't relevant if God gave us the Torah. But the same thing, you can't say the Torah is not at all from God because then it's also irrelevant. So what do? So you find the balance. What's the balance? The balance is
inspired,
divinely inspired. How, who, and what parts of it are inspired? I don't know. Divinely inspired. It's man-made from our wonderful ancestors who were wise and intelligent and moral. And they did it with inspiration from God. This way, there's some wiggle room. There's plenty of wiggle room. But the Torah is still very, very relevant and has a divine aspect to it. Right? That's why the documentary about this works so well. Because it's by your ancestors. And they were writing so long ago that they were still a time when there was maybe prophecy or inspiration from God. So it kind of works well to what the Reform and really now the conservative movement is trying, the message they're trying to say. Right, does that make sense?
The original Reform movement in Germany, did they try to come up with some guidelines what they thought were the parts that were still valid and what parts weren't?
Yeah. Well, basically the moral mitzvot are still valid. Don't kill, don't steal, don't rape, blah, blah, blah. The ritual stuff were not valid, but like we said, there are certain things that they were not going to just, they weren't going to give up so quickly. But kashrut was definitely the first off the list. And like I said, Brit Milah was an interesting place where they had to figure it out. But the concept of the Torah being divinely inspired, I don't know exactly when it starts, but this is not the time. It's not happening in the 1820s, but it's happening, you know, in 1999, they're writing that, because that's, and I'm not, it probably goes back earlier than that for sure. The question is, no?
He also said the Torah is holy. It's holy because it belonged to our ancestors. That's what makes it holy.
It's holy because it belongs to our ancestors and it's divinely inspired. Yeah.
In these other movements that are reconstruction, renewal, I mean, there always seem to be, like, to me, a flavor of Reform. But
it's a more spiritual.
Spiritual, and it's all about being spiritual. You know, it just. I mean, it. Is it just a different way?
Well, because the Reform movement is not very spiritual, right? It's very practical. It's, you know, heal the world, make the world a better place. But it's not very spiritual. I do think that's things like renewal and all these things that's what they're trying to bring back.
They want to bring back God.
They want to bring back God and spirituality, but. And actually, maybe, you know, going the opposite extreme and not focusing so much on the practical world, better place, certainly not mitzvah per se, but they want to bring meditation, spirituality into the mix.
Okay.
Which Reform movement certainly there's no meditation going on in the Reform temple in 1840s Germany. The other big thing becomes the Jewish nation concept. The Reform movement has a huge self-examination with the state of Israel, because according to their platform of 1885, they couldn't really accept it, embrace it in any way, because that the state of Israel is antithetical to really one of the core tenets of what the Reform movement was all about. We're about not going back to Israel. We are citizens of our nation, and America became Americanized, and there was, you know, prominent Reform rabbis, and it was so big, Reform Judaism was so big here, and they had removed any mention of returning to Israel at the same time. To not accept and embrace Israel in 1948 was crazy. So what do? You get rid of one of the major tenets of your movement, or do you just, you know, not embrace Israel? So this was a huge factor, and there was a big split in the Reform movement. Some places began to embrace Israel, other ones said you couldn't, and this is even 1948 and beyond.
There was a lot of rejection.
What?
There was a lot of rejection of Israel.
A lot of rejection of Israel. So I think Temple Emmanuel and Sherith Israel had a big thing. I know when I was in Houston, there were two more foreign temples, and even today they were referred to as, this is the one that embraced the state of Israel, this is the one that didn't. Like, you know, now with the Reform movement, of course, it embraces the state of Israel. How they tie that into their philosophy, so, you know, they finagle it, you know, have enough time
to go. Because Israel is a democracy.
What?
Because Israel is a democracy.
Well, we you know, now, that's another country where you can be a Reformed Jew.
What about the whole concept of Mashiach? How does that
feel? No, they say very clearly, it's gone. It's out. Yeah.
A question about, like, the service. Originally, was it just transliterated, the traditional service, into the German?
I think it's read in German.
And so just the actual service, but just
translated.
Translated.
Yeah. Moses Mendelssohn was the first to put German next to Hebrew. the vernacular next to Hebrew, so you could see what it meant. Yeah.
And so the spiritual, so when it was there a point at which, you know, you're saying it's not so spiritual, they didn't use any of that, the traditional service, but kind of, you know, made up a service, or
I mean,
or that lost parts of it, or
I mean. And they, and around the time of late 1800s, they write their own siddur in America. They create their own siddur, which has, yeah, I haven't seen the 1880s perform siddur, but yeah, they begin to take elements of the traditional liturgy, tweak it, you know.
I see. Okay.
Also, one of the big things becomes the concept of a temple, right? And this makes me kind of nuts, but it's nobody's fault. But Reform begins to call a shul a temple. Why is it called a temple?
Because we don't need the big temple anymore.
Because we're not going back to any temple in Jerusalem. This is our temple now.
Oh, that's a very small.
Right.
That's
a very right. So it's not a shul. It's not a big Knesset. It's not a house of prayer. Yeah. It's the temple. Right. This is our temple now. Sorry. So that's why I mean. Conservative would never call their shul, right? It's not the Beth Shalom temple. They would like, you know. What bothers me is that it's, you know, the term temple is now so pervasive that, you know, Jews, non-Jews, like, oh, do you go to temple? Oh, what temple are you the rabbi of? It's like, I'm not the rabbi of a temple. You know, like, what am I going to get into with this random person? It's like, you're not going to know. Like, every time, it's like, oh, God. And if you only knew what that connotation was, it's a big deal. So it's a very, very big deal. And that still stands till today, still the Reformed temple, right? And that's where it comes from, that's what it's about. Okay, let's talk. Any questions on Reform before we go on from it? Okay. But I do think today there's been a push a little bit to bring some more tradition back to the Reform movement. I think they've gotten the sense that they can't be, you know, the Seinfeld of religion, a religion about nothing, right? So, I remember there's a big controversy in like 1999, 2000, where in the Reformed Temple's big magazine, there was a picture of a Reformed rabbi wearing talus and tefillin on the cover. And this was like a huge thing because, like, you don't do that, right? The joke was that when you enter an Orthodox synagogue, if you're wearing a kippah, there's someone there waiting to hand you one to put on your head. Talking to the Reform Temple, if you're wearing a kippah, there's someone at the front to take it off your head.
Maybe he was just dressed up for Purim.
Right. But the idea was that in theory, Reform movement's about personal choice. That's a big part of the theory. Personal choice. You keep what you want to keep, but you're not obligated to keep much of anything. But, you know, personal choice ends up being doing nothing. Am I, you know, and I, as I've said to the Reform rabbis in town, well, if you have, you know, if you have personal choice, and people, so what percentage of the people in your shul keep kosher? Right? Well, it's personal choice. People can choose whatever. So I'm sure you probably have like a bell curve, right? Of like, things are like, well, this is the kosher, like, if no one, it's like, if you gave your five-year-old personal choice to decide what to have for dinner, right? You know, they have personal choice and they're having ice cream for dinner every night. Why? Because they can. Because no one's, you know. Because, yes, part of religion's job is to get you to do things that you don't naturally want to do, because if we do what we naturally want to do, then we'll always do, you know, we'll simply do the easiest thing, and we won't push ourselves to grow. So, it's very much about personal choice, but it didn't only become about personal choice. Over time, it really became an antagonism towards tradition in any way, because that became kind of a threat to this whole concept. So that became a big thing when this rabbi wore the talus and the tefillin on the cover of the magazine. It sparked this huge debate. In one sense, we're about personal choice, so why can't I wear this, right? Mm-hmm. In another sense, like, whoa, that's not what we're about. But I think that what has developed, and especially a lot of some of the younger Reform rabbis, have kind of taken back. You'll see this in Emmanuel now, where there's a Shavuot night learning program. There's an Omer accounting program. There's a you know, Lag BaOmer or something or rather, right? Because you need to have stuff. You know, you need to have a religion. You need to have something that's inspirational and interesting. So, you know, who knows where this is going to go? You know, but they're definitely in the last 10, 15 years a bit more of a push.
Legitimacy.
What?
They need legitimacy.
Well, it's legitimate, but you need to have, you know, you can't just be the movement that doesn't do stuff. I mean, the conservative movement, we'll just spend a few minutes on that because I want to focus next time on the different Orthodox sects. I want to talk about Hasidism versus Misnagdim. We'll get into Chabad because that's obviously a big one today. And then we'll get into religious Zionism, and what that's about as well. The conservative movement really starts as an offshoot of the Reform movement. It does begin in Germany as well. It's stayed true to its mission in the sense that the conservative movement has always wanted to keep towards Jewish law, but just gave itself a lot more flexibility in how to interpret Jewish law, right? So even till today, if it's going to make any major policy decisions, they need to defend it within Jewish law in some way. At times it borders on the ridiculous, I think, in how they make that happen. But, you know, this really came to a head in 2004 as they, in Houston, when I was living there, that's where the big conservative conference was in Houston that year, and that was the debate on conservative rabbis officiating gay weddings. So there was like three or four different papers that, you know, that were given in, and can you defend it within Jewish law or not? And there's a huge debate about that. But there is at least that concept. Famously, in 1883, there's something called the Treifa Banquet, and this is when the Reform and Conservative were still together. And this is, you know, kind of the early stages, and the Reform movement has this banquet where they serve like the most non-kosher things you could find, right? So there's like shrimp and there's this and that, and then there are people there that are more towards a conservative movement. They left because they said this was like, you know, if at the shul's fundraising dinner they're serving shrimp, then, you know, this is not for us. So then it begins to form in America as some sort of movement. They start JTS, the Jewish Theological Seminary, and have had some very prominent people involved. Make sure I'm not missing anything.
I don't know about now, but they used to be the biggest. Weren't they the biggest affiliation around?
I think Reform has been the biggest for 130 years. Yeah, well, now Reform has an enviable task of trying to, you know, be somewhere in the middle, right? And to teach the next generation. So, you know, the conservative kids who really get excited about their Judaism begin to veer Orthodox. The ones who are not so interested begin to veer Reform. How do you keep that middle balance? It's doable, but It's the line's always changing, and it's a hard thing to do.
Well, I also understood that there was one thing just in terms of people, because Reform was so accepting, and, you know, they do it otherwise. They get more intermarried couples when the other person doesn't convert.
Reform does.
Yeah. And then Orthodox is a higher, you know, marriage and birth rate, and conservative is kind of like...
Yeah, no, conservative is in the middle. I mean, in many ways, it's trying to retain a concept of Jewish law, but at the same time be much more flexible and how that operates. We'll stop here because it's. I mean, but the Reform movement was the big push. Conservative movement, I think, starts off as being an attempt to be a liberal Orthodox movement, but now has gotten to the, you know, again, it's not really that anymore, you know, it hasn't been that way for many years. But if you go back to conservative in the 1940s, 1950s, you'd have a lot of conservative synagogues where, you know, strictly traditional service, pretty observant community, you know, but mixed seating and egalitarianism, that was a thing. And it's just, if you look at this shul versus Ner Tamid, which is a few blocks away, maybe Tommy can speak to this, there wasn't a huge difference in the people as to who went here versus who went there. No. Right?
We got angry here, went there. There,
right.
You know, the two temples in the island.
Right. Now, there's some people who from here who would never go there. Right?
Yeah. And at the same time, they wouldn't come.
Right, exactly. And some people there would never come here.
So you need a third one, where neither will go.
Well, that's Bamboo, right? That was Bamboo. That was the third one. So, yeah.